Hello and welcome to the Johnny Fallon podcast referendum series, where we are taking a look at the referendums that helped to shape and make modern Ireland and the impact each of them had on the voting public, on society and on our politics. This week we are taking a very special look at the legal arguments around referendums, in particular how we hold them, the referendum commission, the rules around that. And I'm delighted to have had the opportunity this week to speak with one of the people I think who is one of the leading experts in this area, Dr. Jennifer Kavanagh from Waterford Institute of Technology. Who is a lecturer and a real expert in this sphere. And it was a great opportunity for me to have a chat with Jennifer and just see exactly what are the kind of things we can do in referendums. Where did it all come from in terms of the legals behind us, the thinking behind it? Why do we need the referendum commission? Why maybe do some politicians think it should be go back to the old ways before, when we didn't have to fund a fair argument, if you like, and it could all be funded just out of a government backing one side or other in a referendum? Why can't we do that? And why is it beneficial? And what are the improvements we could be making to that process? So sit back and enjoy. I think this interview is a great opportunity to explore just a different technical side to referendums, which changed a lot during the 1990s. And that's why this is an opportune time to have this interview with Jennifer and get her sense maybe of the impacts of that and what needs to happen and can still happen in Irish referendums in the years ahead. A big part of referendums, of course, is the legal background to them. And Ireland has seen many legal challenges and developments in how we approach referendums due to those legal challenges. And this week, I am joined by a very special guest, Dr. Jennifer Kavanagh, lecturer in law in Waterford Institute of Technology. You're very welcome to the podcast, Jen.
Thanks for having me on, Johnny.
Listen, tell me, you know, when we talk about the referendums, I suppose what many people know is that, you know, we had a couple of referendums in the 70s. You know, we had the voting ones, you know, and the voting system back in the 60s. And then all of a sudden, referendums began to change, largely through legal challenges from the 80s onwards. Why was that? What began to happen in the court system with referendums?
I don't think it was so much what happened in the court system, but we have in the legislation governing referendums what's known as referendum petitions. So if someone feels that there was a material defect in the way in which the referendum was carried out, they are entitled to apply to court to challenge the result of the referendums. Now, they were always there in elections. There are things that weren't really used that much, but once it came to the divorce referendum, especially the follow-on from the McKenna case, the amount of referendums that were being challenged in the court, it became more common for it to happen. So with the McKenna case, that was to do with the divorce referendum, the booklet that was published by the government, which was straying more into the territory of campaigning as opposed to informing. We got from that the referendum commission itself. But in the Hannafin case that followed on from that, the argument was made that the government stepping outside their box in that regard, they argued, was a material defect because they claimed it was putting people in a position where they felt the people weren't getting unbiased information, that they were being nudged in one direction or another. And they felt that that was a material defect. And remember, that divorce referendum, the numbers were so, so close that it could be a mechanism to undermine the result. And that would then mean that the result that was given wasn't necessarily a result that was the full will of the people being exercised full and fairly.
And tell us about this, because it's quite interesting, because we've been covering these referendums and we went back to the 80s with the Crotty judgment, of course, on referendums. Then you went into the Maastricht and abortion referendums, and there were queries about funding and spending on those kind of things. There was a debate beginning about it. But as you say, it really comes down, the massive change that I suppose most people remember is the McKenna judgment, because up to that point, government decides to have a referendum. They decide, well, look, you know, we're for this referendum and we want to convince people to back our proposal. So if we have £1 million to spend, we spend it on the referendum and telling people, vote yes, back this referendum. But the McKenna judgment comes in and puts an end to that. That's after the divorce referendum in 95, isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, it was such a big case. I was only a kid at the time and I remember it, but that probably shaped the fact that I'm now a lecturer in constitutional law, not necessarily representative of the entire childhood demographic at the time. But with McKenna, the judgment came out 1 or 2 days beforehand. So in reality, it would have only affected the postal votes that went in. And as you know, it's hard enough to get a postal vote in Ireland. But the thing is, the role of the government is to have the mechanics in place to hold a referendum. So you got enough ballot papers printed, you got enough ballot boxes, you got enough count staff, things like that. That beyond that, the party political role is separate. So there's almost now a tightrope that has to be walked. And it also came up as well with the children's rights referendum, that for a minister to speak as a voice of government, that you should vote in this particular manner. That's not on anymore. But for example, the current government, Fianna Fáil, the Greens, Fine Gael, to canvass as a party for a particular result, that is different. And in McKenna, with the divorce referendum, that line became blurred. And it was the document that came out was from the government. The government was looking for people to vote in a certain direction, and that's transgressing the boundaries. And that's exactly what happened as well with the children's rights referendum, that it came from the Department of Children. And that by having the stamp of the government department wasn't really kosher. The government is only there to ensure the mechanics are in place. Now, the word was around the children's rights one that maybe McKenna and Hanifin that came after it had possibly gone too far, and maybe it would have been something that the courts would have relooked at, but the courts decided in exactly the same way. So there has to be that ring fencing of the functions between the political and the governmental, and that they shouldn't be cross-pollinating when it comes to nudging people in one direction or another on a referendum proposal.
And this is an interesting one, Jennifer, because it's one that exercised a lot of politicians at the time, a lot of people involved in politics, and of course the political parties, because it's all really here about views of democracy. Because isn't it fair to say, look, a government's job is to lead. That's what you elect them for. They're there to put in place laws, to put in place decisions. They enforce laws every day of the week in the Oireachtas. They have votes, they have whips, they whip TDs into voting a certain way. That's what we expect of them. That's why we elected them in the first place, to take decisions and lead. And when it comes to a referendum, isn't it an obvious step that a government should lead and say, this is what we want, this is what the government you elected wanted to do, rather than saying, well, no, the government only puts the mechanics of it in, that's fine, but then it's up to political parties, who are probably stony broke anyway, to find money somewhere in the state or by private donations to go and actually campaign on an issue. And, you know, there was a lot of debate about this at the time, because people, certainly within politics, there was an argument that says, this isn't right. You know, governments should be able to lead and spend the money that's there, advising the people that elected them, this is what we want you to do, this is what we think is right, rather than this. Because after this, we get quite a confused picture ever since on referendums for those who don't follow politics. So was there an argument at court? Is there still any doubt about that? Or is it generally accepted now government should just not spend anything on debating with the people or informing the people as regards voting a particular way?
Well, the government can govern by virtue of the constitution. And if that constitution is something that is to be changed, then therefore the power of that constitution comes from the people, So therefore, I can see where they came from with the McKenna judgment and the McChrystal judgment in the children's rights referendum, because a constitution and its changes have to be the expression of the will of the people. And that if you have, and bear in mind, like we had the parliamentary inquiries referendum, which every single party, I can't think off the top of my head of any major party that was against that, but still the people said, we're not quite comfortable with giving you all this power. We're not quite sure, so we're going to vote no. So I can understand from the side of politics that it's, well, what's the difference between your man speaking as a minister and your man speaking as a TD who's a member of a party? It looks like a very overly nuanced division. But at the end of the day, if people are being asked to make a decision on an issue, it comes down to Article 6, where pretty much saying that the people are sovereign and that they have the final decision, that they need to be allowed to work in that particular space whereby the government, and this came out in some of the subsequent judgments as well, that if a government is trying to push through a referendum that absolutely nobody wants, and they're able to use our tax money in order to do that, that's not particularly democratic either. So I can understand where people entrenched in politics are coming from, but from a constitutional perspective, the constitution is the document that was passed originally by the people in 1936. The government gets their power from that constitution. They are a subdivision of the constitution, like the judiciary as well. And they shouldn't really have the power to say, "Grand, we've all the cash, let's spend all the money, and we'll get through the decision that we want."
And tell me then, because in the time after McKenna judgment, then in subsequent referendums, we have had what some people might find quite a confused story of what happened with government funding after that, because we had a referendum commissions, we had situations where and it's been adapted and changed over the years where they were giving the facts of the case and they were giving the arguments for and against voting for a proposal, which I remember people finding incredibly confusing on documentation. That one page was everything for and the other page was everything against, and then it was amended to no, here's just the facts of it and here's just the details of it, but no details on how to vote. A lot of people find some of that information, is it worthwhile anymore even having that information when really there's the parties are putting out telling you what way to vote? Did it confuse the public, a public who aren't really engaged in this process anyway, and suddenly get all this literature and some of it's more indecisive, it would seem, than what they're actually what they would have thought themselves just looking at the TV?
Well, the bear in mind that the referendum commission was really just a way of dealing with the judgment in the McKenna case. And it really highlights the overall problems with integrity in the both the referendum and the electoral system, in that we need to have that full-time electoral commission that also looks after the referendums, because one of the main issues, and this was really highlighted in, say, the Eighth Amendment referendum and the marriage equality referendum, the dogs in the street knew there was going to be a referendum, and there was information coming out from left, right, and centre. And the referendum commission is only an ad hoc body that is set up one generally once the legislation, as in the bill for the amendment, passes its stages in the houses. So everyone knows this referendum is coming. There's no referendum commission set up, and it has been criticised even by its own members, where they said, "You've set us up, there's a month to go with this, but we've got 6 months' work to do, and it's unmanageable." So what we do need a referendum commission, but it needs to be part of an electoral commission, where not only is it a case that they can deal with what's coming out, that because like we have a slate of referendums, like planes on a landing platform pattern going into Heathrow Airport. We have a raft of referendums to come. Everyone knows they're coming, but there's no overall coordination management of the situation, which is the problem at the moment. And I totally agree that the position that they were put in by saying, here's one page on what's going on here, here's one page on what the if you go on the other side of it. And bear in mind, it was predominantly written by lawyers. And people who come through law are not generally known as being the most, straightforward people. It's kind of, do you want a coffee? Well, there's many different exceptions to coffee, and there may be tea instead of a yes or a no. You never get a yes or a no from a lawyer. We don't even know how to do it. So that is a problem in itself. The reason why you would need an independent body doing it is because if you've one party giving a logical, this is what happens if you vote yes, this is what happens if you vote no, sure, half the people say, well, sure, of course they'd say that because they want people to vote for it. So it's not that I wouldn't trust the political parties not to do it properly. I would be wary that people would take it on face value for what it is. So really, the referendum commission needs to be part of that electoral commission, which hopefully we'll get some idea of with the electoral reform bill that is proposed to come out soon enough. And it needs to be placed in there along with all the disinformation issues that we've had in previous referendums as well.
And talk to me a little bit about some of that, because that is one of the major challenges. People looking at a referendum, deciding they're going to vote yes or no to a proposal, they look at the parties. Fair enough. If they trust a party, then they say, okay, I trust that party, that leader, and therefore I'm going to vote that way. That's fine. But for a huge amount of voters who are in the middle, who don't engage with politics, they don't trust the parties, as you say. They feel, well, I don't want to listen to that because that's what they would say. They would tell me that. And then you get into these absolute, things that tell you, oh, it's the sky is going to fall in, and the other side, the sky absolutely will not fall
Yes, the
in.
chicken licking
Who's to
lobby, as
judge?
I call them.
Yeah, and how do you even get a referendum commission to handle that? How will we ever be at a point where there is accepted by all sides, okay, that's the ultimate authority, the fact checker, if you like. Isn't it kind of impossible? Because one side or other is always going to say, we're telling you the truth. Every side believes they're telling the truth. They believe what they're happening, even though it can't be proven, maybe.
Well, to be honest with you, if you had that properly funded electoral commission, they would actually, like, say, the Law Reform Commission, that should be really taken as a template. They do extraordinary work on looking comparatively at different aspects of law, what would be the best way to reform and change the law in Ireland. Fantastic team of researchers in the Law Reform Commission. And if you modelled a division, say, of the Electoral Commission dealing with referendums on that type of a basis, you would, like, 90% of the people would actually be able to say, yes, these people, they are experts in this area. They've engaged with all the people on the area. They know what they're talking about. A bit like the Citizens' Assembly and the Constitutional Convention, that you had in experts and they were to present their views on it. So it wasn't a case of, well, yes, they would say that, or, as I said, the chicken licking lobby, that, whatever you vote for, the sky will fall in anyway. That people as well, though, they do have to take that self-responsibility, though, to be engaged, because nobody's going to come to your door with the golden ticket of this is how you're personally supposed to vote in this referendum. And honestly, I think an enormous amount of credit is due to the Irish population, because when we have a referendum proposal that we're not quite sure of, our default is to vote no. And that's a very, it's a very sensible way to go about things, because they say, well, we don't really understand what the full repercussions of this is, so we're going to vote no. So if you look at, say, Nice and Lisbon, I know a lot of people would say, you gave the wrong answer, you have to vote again. But what nearly everyone forgets are those protocols that we got. So we got it in writing exactly what these particular aspects that there were legitimate concerns about, and got those worked into it. So the Irish electorate is actually very savvy, and yes, there will always be a very small proportion who have, shall we say, interesting ideas on how they voted in particular ways. But certain things like Irish neutrality is always something that Irish people are going to be concerned with, and we got protocols dealing with that. And like I said, the parliamentary inquiries referendum, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties has to be really commended on the campaign that they ran on a shoestring. But it put legitimate questions into people's minds on the breadth of powers that could come out of that particular referendum. And the Irish people just went, not quite sure, so we're going to vote no. Another example will be cabinet confidentiality, held at the same time as one of the presidential elections. The amount of people who either handed back their ballot paper or just folded it up and didn't make any mark on it to spoil their ballot was noted. And people said, well, there was probably an issue with that, because if most people just said, we don't know what this is about, we're not going to vote on it, it was eventually passed in that referendum. But the Irish people who vote tend to be quite savvy on their way of making decisions as well.
What though about these kind of issues? Because I always find it an interesting challenge for those who are put in that position, like that of being the judge of what's factual and what's not, and what's honest in the debate, and giving that straight down the line view. Because if you go back to something like the divorce referendum in 95, where this started out of, and we can do that now, looking back with the time and space between now and then, where we can identify, you know, what has actually happened. So we know that at that point, one side, one argument was, if you allow divorce in, there's going to be a raft of divorces. We're going to be overrun with people deserting their wives, deserting their husbands, and there's going to be an enormous bill from people who are just waiting there to get divorced, and have first opportunity to get the will, and we're going to have this massive problem in the country. Now, we know now, we can look back and say that was nonsense, okay? Never happened. There was no backlog of people just itching to get divorced all the time, first opportunity they'd get. But if you said that, and you could go back and put up a referendum commission and say, look, is this fact? And they said at the time of the referendum, no, we don't believe that's going to happen. That's not. You would have been met with another group who said, you can't say that for sure. You can't say that that's not a fact, because you don't know at the time that's not going to happen. And these kind of arguments that are out there all the time, they're in referendums that really we don't know, and we can't give an unequivocal answer to, even though we might feel it's nonsense and no evidence points to it. But you can't say for sure. And I mean, isn't that kind of what between Brexit, Trump, these little kind of grey areas around the edges that people are able to just create enough doubt and then say, referendum commission are in on this. You know, they're telling you they're fact checking, but they're really just part of mainstream media, yada yada, all that kind of thing. Isn't that part of the problem?
Well, to be fair, that when the referendum commission were giving their perspective on things, it was always the legal or the constitutional. They tended to stay away from any social impacts, because, as you say, there is no constitutional law magic ball that you can look up and say, well, this is exactly what will happen. I mean, that came up as well in the repeal the eighth referendum as well. But it's really focusing on what does this change mean in a legal sense on, say, rights, on, say, any subsequent legislation that will come from that. So, for example, in repeal the eighth, that's why they released the heads of bill, because they didn't really want to get into that big, massive constitutional argument. But they just said that it was the Department of Health issued it and said, if it was to happen, this is what we're thinking of. So it gave people that frame of reference that they felt that the government would act in. But if you're getting into, say, statistical projections of what you think will happen from something being changed in the constitution, nobody can really make any, you couldn't make a factual argument, because you wouldn't have any evidence to back it up to begin with.
Tell me this then, you know, when we talk about referendums, as you say, if you could get the referendum commission and we were to reform it and we were to put it into, say, an electoral commission, something that's there all the time, something that can react to ongoing to this, and seems like a sensible proposal. I mean, does that fix it? Have we other problems in it? Because there's a lot of people out there just picking up on what you were saying earlier, you know, about the sensible thing of the Irish. Church. There's an argument that says Irish people aren't sensible at all about the referendums. Look, they just haven't a clue. They don't engage. And then they go, Irish or no, don't trust the politicians. Vote no to everything. Vote no to it once anyway, and be sure. And that they don't really come out. And the whole thing of voting no is just a bad habit they get into, because we've lost faith in politics and we've lost faith in politicians. And it's just a default setting now of, you know, that some would argue maybe it's actually easier to be on the anti-political party side. And there's no surer way of getting a referendum defeated than to have all the politicians agree that it's something they want to put through. And much easier then to actually defeat that by just creating a bit of doubt and saying, you know, like, do they work? Do you think there's a habit now of getting in? And can that be solved by having trust in a body like an electoral commission? Can they engender a trust that moves people away from that? Or is that just a politician's argument?
No, I think there is wider issues. So, for example, with a referendum commission as part of an electoral commission, they would be at arm's length from the government, and at arm's length from any political party. So there would be like nobody goes around saying about the Law Reform Commission, not sure they're only branch of government, sure they'd say that anyway, because they have worked so hard at creating such a good reputation for the quality of the work that they do. But one major issue that I'm not quite sure if a referendum or electoral commission will be able to deal with, but it is something that really needs to be looked at, is electoral disinformation, which feeds into that narrative that you're talking about there with somebody who doesn't trust anyone or anything. And if you remember during Repeal the Eighth, the tech companies in Dublin, such as Google and the like, just said, look, we're not taking any ads. There's always going to be issues with funding when it comes to Irish political parties. And if you're allowing campaign groups to get money and the source may not be 100% accounted for because it might be an ad that's been posted by some crowd in, I'll just take off the top of my head, Illinois, but it's showing up on Irish YouTube users because that's where the ad has been targeted. There needs to be a better way of managing that, because if you're dealing with, say, a global disinformation campaign, it's very hard to track it, to see what's happening. Whereas at least if it's registered groups, and there is problems as well with how third parties are dealt with in electoral law, I personally think it's far too broad and something that needs urgent reform because it's stifling. That yes, everyone has a right to a political opinion, but if you are using pretty much outright misinformation or disinformation in order to push that campaign, there needs to be some way of dealing with that effectively that also doesn't stifle political expression. Because if you end up with something that is too much of a sledgehammer to crack a nut, the impact on democracy itself is too large. So, for example, the advertising standards bodies obviously don't touch political advertising with a barge pole. And for very understandable reasons, it was good of what Google and the like did with Repeal the Eighth to just shut it down as a blunt instrument, them being a private company, not necessarily having to accept any ads on it because they could just change their terms very, very quickly. That something definitely needs to be looked into with that, because if you have people with genuine doubts, and people, look, people are entitled to have doubts, to ask questions, not to be looked down on, or sure, that's one of those people, sure, they'd say no to everything. It's a bad mindset to get into because people have a right to ask questions and they also have a right not to agree. But if they are getting thrown information that is not based on genuine concerns and has been used for a particular outcome that you could say is almost nefarious, that there is an issue with that. And at least if there is that electoral referendum commission that is there at arm's length, that is not overtly connected with the government or with any political parties, that at least people can say, well, look, I know you don't exactly trust what's going on, but there is this independent body over here. And look, credit has to be given as well to the media on this, because in the main, the broadcasters in Ireland do have that balance and parity when they are dealing with, say, referendum debates, literally there with a stopwatch, checking that everyone's on the same time. And the broader media, for example, the Journal does fantastic fact checking on these proposals that go through, and that those people have to be given credit as well for what they are doing and trying to cut through that misinformation and disinformation noise.
And I think there's probably a big education piece there for people, because of course, we've seen it in recent times. You see it now. I mean, we're in the midst of a COVID pandemic and people talk about vaccines and all that. And then you see when the Journal or somebody does a fact check, then they're automatically assumed, oh, it's not a proper fact check, and it's they're part of some conspiracy there. So there's always somebody to say the who's fact checking the fact checkers, and that debate rages on. But
you know, I'm interested in what you're saying there about the disinformation thing and what's possible to do with companies. Because I'm a big fan of social media, and I'm a big fan of the fact that, you know, people can go out there. And I do think it's important that people now can express views that maybe weren't possible, and people are preaching from their ivory towers in media and in what's now called mainstream media or traditional media 30 years ago. And there was no way to challenge it an awful lot of the time. Social media has overturned all that. So I think there's a lot of positives. One of the things, though, that worries me about it is that if I go on, let's say there's a referendum on in the morning, and I could be on either side of it, whether I'm for the referendum or against it. But if I'm only slightly for it or slightly against it, as you say, I want to go and research something, and I end up on something like YouTube, or I end up going into an article on Facebook or whatever, because I say, oh, right, that's my doubt about that. That's it. That's my question going to be answered. That algorithm is going to produce more articles that talk about that doubt, or more articles. And if I'm on YouTube, I'll guess, like, if I go in, if we had a referendum in the morning about, I don't know, the use of vaccines, because it's a topical thing in the midst of a pandemic. And if we were to put something like that in a referendum now, and I were to go on YouTube and say, well, is this what's actually happening? I'd be brought to a video, and gradually the videos I'll encounter will be more and more extremist as it goes, because the algorithm thinks this is what you want, and we want to give you what you want. How do we ensure that we actually reach, for referendum commissions and bodies like that that we're talking about, how do we reach in an age of social media and that we ensure that people are getting balanced information, that they're seeing both sides of an argument, that they're not being led down one path by an algorithm that may even be doing this unwittingly or not knowing it's really, that may not be its intention. But that's what tends to happen. So how do you combat that from a, you know, a very traditional body like a referendum commission in this new world? Or is it even possible?
Well, you'll never be able to legislate for every single thing that could happen on the internet. But for example, when it comes to the American elections and Twitter, that you do have that kind of warning on it that this is an individual that is looking for election, what they've been doing to Trump's tweets, things like that. But you do have a very good point there about the algorithm, and a lot of studies that have gone into it, where you are increasingly going towards more darker corridors on YouTube or wherever you're getting your media content from. And I would think that if there was to be that referendum election commission type body set up, that Google and those were quite willing to engage with trying to deal with this mis and disinformation when it came to repeal the 8th. And I think that there is a willingness that there could be an engagement there if it is that independent body, because on an optics basis, you wouldn't, if you were one of those companies, you wouldn't want to be seen to be doing anything at the behest of any particular government, because that would have implications of maybe censorship or, you know, soft level corruption, things like that between different parties. But I think if there was going to be that independent body, and as I said, if you're not waiting for a referendum commission to be established, you can do a lot more proactive work in advance of any referendum proposal that would be there. So it would come down to a negotiation between the referendum electoral commission with those companies. And for the preservation of democracy, and considering what they have done in previous times, I think there is a possibility that something could be trashed out that would ensure that people are getting information, be that maybe creating more verified accounts, things like that, for people who are active in that area, or just even having those blanket restrictions or confines whereby if there is an election, if there is a referendum proposal, there will only be advertising related to that jurisdiction that will be there. But look, if somebody wants to go through a VPN or any of those circuitous ways around the internet, there really wouldn't be any way of dealing with that.
Tell me, Jim, you know, in terms of the because someone like yourself who studied law, and, you know, obviously law is a huge passion of yours, and you've become like one of the leading experts in this whole space now in the country. So, you know, it's obviously something that goes to the very core of who you are and what your academic
is. If you cut me in half, you'll probably find a tally.
Well, But, you know, there is that thing, like, the Constitution's this great thing, you know, and you're taught to respect the Constitution. Then the idea of referendums are great, you know, because you put something in the Constitution, it's there unless the people want to change it and politicians can't muck around with it. And when I'm at my most idealistic, I can give you loads and loads of great speeches and things about it and why it's wonderful and why it's in, and I can be very idealistic about it. On the other hand, there's another part of me that's this incredible pragmatist that knows it can be in government, can be sitting in a room and you're thinking, oh, for God's sake, not the Constitution again. Don't tell me this is one of those things we can't just get on and change. We have to put it to the people. And you're thinking, this is a night. If we could just move it, no one would even notice we made the change. We could actually bring in the new law from the EU. We could be part of that treaty. We could, you know, adjust whatever it is that we're doing in legal terms or with statute, and nobody would even notice. Everything would be fine. But instead, we've got this constitution. We have to go out to the people, and you know what that's going to mean? The people. It's going to be a pain in the ass. We're going to get a whole load of groups who are just going to complain about it and argue about it and come up with the most ridiculous kind of stuff. And I'm going to have to go out and argue against that. And I'm going to have to figure out a way of spending what limited funds I have now on this and not getting re-elected or doing what I might see as important stuff. All because of this constitution and these referendums and all of that. So from that point of view, there is a time, I know no politician's ever going to say it, but behind closed doors, there's a bit of a pain in the ass and we've got to go back out to the people because we might face these crazy arguments. So my question to you from that is, you know, from your point of view, looking at that, does it work? Do referendums actually work? Or, you know, given the low turnouts, given the fact that every time, no matter what's done, people say, I didn't have enough information or I didn't bother voting because I wasn't sure what it meant. You know, is it ever feasible? Like, are referendums really a great way to do business? Or, you know, is there a better way?
I think the Constitution has been given a bad reputation by certain elements in politics, because you're absolutely right. There's certain things that they want to do. And they would be told, no, you might need a constitution change for that. I'll give you the perfect example. The rent freezes that came in during the pandemic. For years, can't do a constitution. COVID, yeah, we can do it. No hassle. It's in. So there can be a certain amount of conservatism that I think comes from being litigation adverse. That, for example, if they just said, look, let's try it. It'll cost us, what, 20 million to do a referendum. If we put it in and we wait for someone to challenge us, nobody might find out that it is unconstitutional. And sure, look, probably in damages, what we'd have to give out is 5 million. So there is, and a lot of constitutional law academics, and there has been a couple of issues now where we've had to kind of meet up in under Chatham House rules and discuss things and just check, look, or have some of us gone mad here in the way we're thinking? It's like, actually, no, you're not, because 90% of us are thinking the same way. That there is this whole idea that the Constitution is something that is holding up political change when it's not. It's the way that it's being interpreted. And look, there's enough legislation that's found unconstitutional, even after all these checks and balances. It happens. It's almost like that star student who doesn't even want to be caught using Tippex in school. That, you know, life happens, you might interpret it the wrong way, but look, in general, it's been done for the public good. Take, for example, those rent freezes, and let's see how it rolls. That referendums can be dragged in for the wrong reasons. And then referendums can be very idealistically put forward, but they may also not be the best way to solve a problem. That my example that I would give would be the right to housing, because we have a separation of powers. The judiciary cannot turn around to government and say, give Mrs. Kelly there a house in Ballydehob because she's a right to housing in the Constitution, because the government cannot be told what to do by the judiciary. Totally get where people are coming from on the right to housing. In fact, I'd love to have a discussion with them, because I would love to see where they're coming from on this. But from my perspective, if you put in a right to housing into the Constitution, firstly, what does a house get defined as? A two-bit shack at the back of the Liberties or a 4.5 million mansion down on the Blackrock Road in Cork? What is a house? And you could end up spending 20, 25 million on running that referendum when you could build a lot of houses for that money. So that I would think is one of the ones where, do you really want to go down the path of a referendum on that? And then there's other things where we do definitely need a referendum. One of those would be changing the terminology or possibly removing that whole piece on women in the home, which has frustrated feminists since the dawn of the current constitution. And also the fact that we need a referendum to be part of the European Patent Court. And when you think so much of our economy is on research and development, it's ridiculous that we haven't held that referendum already. So,
and nobody will probably show up to it when they do, because they'll go, why the hell do we have to
vote on this? It'll be more like
that
central bank ad, sorry, what's a patent to begin with? So the constitution gets a bad rap from people trying to think it's the be all and end all of how Ireland runs. Now, it is, legally speaking, but the real politics of how things can be done can get you around situations where people are just too risk adverse. As I said, with the rent, with the rent holidays over the coronavirus pandemic. So the one trend I have seen more of is, and this has been with the government that has gone in since June, that both the government and the opposition are just getting that little bit more clued in on the constitution. Because in previous governments, it was like, the reason why we can't put up traffic lights down in Rathfarnham is because of the constitution. It was getting to that level. Whereas now they are being more nuanced in their application of bringing in the constitution. So they are learning, and I'm glad to see that.
I find that a fascinating argument, because there's a couple of points that I think are fascinating in that. Number one, I have to say, I agree. I think first of all, on the idea that you know, sometimes referendums on things are proposed as a solution to everything. And generally, when I look at some of those issues, it's like, would be great to insert a constitutional right on something. Anytime we've done that, no more than when they inserted the right to life in 1983, and then, you know, it creates a bigger problem longer term, and had ended up meaning the opposite to what they'd intended, because all of those kind of headaches that came with that. And very often it comes because the only purpose of people saying that is they want to win a referendum. They want to make a point, and they want to say it's not to actually achieve something that will be a tangible action. It's more, we have this, so you can put in a right to housing, say, and as you say, I'm not going to say what a house is or how the house is. We'll deal with all that. That's someone else's problem to deal with after. What we did, though, is we won the referendum, and that said there's a right to housing,
and
even though it won't make any difference
after,
of that, because it's a nice thing
to win. Is the article stating the woman's place in the home. That has never given any woman any form of support. I mean, we've a generation of women now who've hit their 70s who would have been subject to the marriage bar and civil service, weren't able to avail of the homemaker's credit. And when the stamps, which as I call them, stamps or your PRSI contributions for getting your pension, were changed, that entire generation was removed from a pension, even though they were doing what the constitution said that they should be doing. They had to wait for the Family Home Protection Act to come in for women to get a veto on their husband selling the house over their heads. We know of many families where the husband just came in, said, sold the house, move on. And that was it. And that article, which it's done nothing but cause problems and give women blood pressure, it's just there as a social gesture from what probably worked in 1937, even though the ICA were given out about it at the time. And it should be removed. But some people are saying, well, why don't we change the wording to carers? But sure, if it's done nothing for women, how's it going to do anything for carers? It's better just to get rid of the thing.
Yeah, it's not going to change anything. Again, it reminds me too, if you remember the Articles 2 and 3 which of the Constitution, which went after the Good Friday Agreement, and people clung to them for so long and so many years, and they annoyed unionists no end. And then when you actually sat down and thought, what is the point in having a claim to counties when the British
that
Army
actually
is
came from
the
McGimsey
border,
case.
You're never going to
because
get
unionists came down to Dublin and challenged the Dublin courts. And it's almost like that TIAD where, you know, there's the big talk and the small talk and the girl talk. The Irish government was trying to say, oh, listen, it's just talk. Don't be worrying about that. Look, we're not going to go up to Belfast and claim it's our bit. But the courts actually said, no, lads, you have it written in there. It's not just political talk. It's actually something you should be pursuing. And then we knew the game was up with those Articles 2 and 3, because not only were they causing the problems, but now we had to do something about it. And that's not something we want to do at all. So they said, Good Friday Agreement, granddad's, that's sorted, 2 and 3, not a problem. And literally turned around saying, thank goodness that has gone off our plate.
And I think it's fascinating, too, when you say about, you know, the politicians having the fear of, you know, we can't do that because of the Constitution. I think it's really interesting to hear someone like yourself from that constitutional law background saying, look, sometimes go ahead and implement the law and just do the thing and then see what happens. You know, see if it's unconstitutional. You know, let's let the rubber hit the road here and get on and do things. Because it's one thing that frustrates me so much about politics all the time is the politicians have loved, as you say, the risk averse. They don't want to say, they don't want to have it on their table. So it becomes easier to shove it off the edge and say, well, Constitution won't allow me. And I think that's very like what we've often done with the EU. So for instance, we did it, and it did it in Britain too, and it's backfired on them there. But you know, governments sit at the Council of Ministers in the EU. They sign off on every law, on every directive, everything that comes through. If it's an environment directive, your environment minister is there signing off. If it's your finance minister on a finance directive, they sign off. That's where the action happens. But then they come back, and instead of taking responsibility and saying, yeah, we hammered this out, we talked to it, we went through the rule and I signed off on it, they go, yeah, the EU made us do it. You know, we don't want to do this to you, but it's an EU regulation. And it makes people go,
it's like the Constitution EU, you know, and the EU are two heavies in the background swinging baseball bats with the implicit threat of do it or we'll kill you.
Yeah, yeah. And it is. And it's hilarious with the Constitution, which doesn't even have a person, if you like, to personify it. But it's this kind of, oh, well, I would do it, but Constitution's going to stop me. And then you kind of, you're having that kind of, I think, idea of, well, you know, maybe it doesn't. Maybe go and try it and let's see what the challenge is like to it. And let's see if it's unconstitutional at that point. That maybe, you know, we just need braver politicians that are actually willing to do it. And I think it has been an excuse over time. But Jen, we've finished up, but I want to ask you one final question, which you've mentioned, you know, the Electoral Commission. But aside from that, if I were able to give you almighty power now to say, right, you know, constitutionally, the whole system between the Constitution, referendums, how it works electorally, the interaction with parties, all of it, and you could actually make any changes you want to improve that, what would you say are the priorities that we should be looking at in that whole space now?
Oh, there's so many different things to pick from. But if I had all power, I would actually firstly start saying I want pockets and skirts and dresses, which has nothing to do with electoral or referendum commission. I think when we look at the administration of politics in Ireland, the one thing I would do is put it all, and I know this is probably almost a politician's answer to this question, and you'll be giving out about politicians so much. I think the whole thing has to start with getting all those functions in one body. Because if you're looking at, say, the electoral register, which needs absolute root and branch sorting out, that's left with the county councils. They have enough work to be doing. So that all needs to go into one body. And for example, for the presidential election, it was the only election I didn't manage to vote in because I was up in Dublin for stuff. I couldn't get back down and then I had to be back up again then for stuff to do with count. And I was walking past the polling place on Bagot Street there, the little national school that's by where the Department of Health is. And I was like, this is absolutely ridiculous. There should have been some way that I could have contacted someone and say, listen, can I move my vote from Waterford to the nearest polling station? You should be able to get up a map and be able to see where the nearest polling station is. And surely in this day and age, can I not just get the same ballot paper I would have been voting on in Waterford and just get another one up in Dublin? That there's small things like that that make life easier for people who want to be engaged. That, for example, the postal ballot, it works for students. It works for people who are, say, in a different part of the country for voting, but you nearly need to apply for that a month in advance. And most people don't know they're going to be away at that stage. That all that stuff could be done a lot more clearly and simply. Now, yes, we don't want to put too much of it online because, as was said to me, it's very hard for the Russians to hack the Irish electoral system. Sure, it's all on paper. You know, there's that perspective on it as well. But if you had that synergy of the administration from the councils being moved into centralised or regionalised bodies, If you had SIPL working together with that, if you had a proper research wing in it, because I remember for many years, the Political Studies Association of Ireland, of whom I'm a member, it's an academic organisation for people involved in the study of politics in Ireland. They were the ones who were funding the national election surveys and holding on to all the information. That's not really good enough. That information should be centrally kept and funded by the government to ensure there's a proper record of what's going on. That once all these bodies can be brought in under one, the synergies that you can have coming out of that can actually make our electoral system so much more user-friendly and up-to-date. Because, I mean, I'm the one when it comes to, say, if I'm in class and there's some ructions going on, looks like there could be an election, I'm the one who's going onto our virtual learning system and putting up links for them on how to get their postal vote. That it should be much easier for people to get all this different information and get it all in one centralized area. And let's get the basics right first before we start going on with any big grand schemes of, like, we can't manage in disinformation and misinformation if we can't keep an electoral register up to date.
Totally agree, Jen. I love that. Something so simple and could be so effective. And it makes you wonder why we haven't done it already. So let's hope somebody listens in. And
feel free to give me a call if you need a hand.
Sounds like it. I think you'd be first on their speed dial. Listen, Jennifer Kavanagh, who lecturer in law at Waterford Institute of Technology, thank you so much for coming on and giving us the benefit of all of that experience and insight. It's deeply appreciated.
So that was my interview with Jennifer Kavanagh of Waterford Institute of Technology. And I want to thank Jennifer for giving me her time and her experience, which I think was rather enlightening on the process and what actually happens in referendums and what maybe are the kind of things we should be thinking about in referendums in the future. In the future episodes, we will be returning to yet more episodes where we're going to look at the Amsterdam Treaty. We're also going to take a run through upcoming treaties that you have to look forward to, such as Nice and Lisbon, which are very exciting, and a couple of really thorny social issues that cropped up as well, some of which are still haunting us now. So do look out for those coming towards you in the coming weeks from the Johnny Fallon podcast as we continue our run through the referendums that have helped to shape and make modern Ireland. Thank you for listening. Thank you once again, and do spread the word about the podcast when and where you can, particularly on Twitter. If you have any questions, please contact me at Johnny Fallon. That's at JonnyFallon on Twitter, where I would absolutely love to hear from you. Finally, I want to thank once again Car Communications for supporting this podcast and allowing me the time, space, effort and access to the library, of course, to make all of the recordings and research happen, and for the team's input along the way into each episode. So thank you all. Stay safe, and we will see you very soon with another episode in our referendum series.